Hi, I'm Alicia.
And I'm Robin, and you're listening to Bowel Moments,
the podcast sharing real talk about the realities of IBD. Served on the rocks. This week, we talked to Marita Kamedas. Marita is an advanced practice provider leader, IBD APN, and ostomy specialist at the IBD Center at the University of Chicago. As you can guess, we talked to her about all things ostomy, including talking to patients about ostomies and preparing them to get ostomies, advances in ostomy technology and the research that she's doing, peristomal pyroderma gangrenosa and other issues that may come up when you're dealing with an ostomy, and how ostomies can be incredibly life-changing for patients. Cheers.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Bowel Moments. This is Robin.
Hey, guys. This is Alicia. And boy, are we excited to talk to our guest today. We are joined by Marita Kamedas. Marita, you are a nurse at the University of Chicago IBD Clinic, and we have so many questions for you. But our first very unprofessional question for you is, what are you drinking?
I laugh. My husband is a big connoisseur of all types of drinks. We have 1,000 types of sparkling waters and things like that. So right now I've decided to do a nice dry chili glass of rosé, which will probably be followed by a lot of sparkling water.
Oh, it is rosé time. And I love a good dry rosé. Good choice. Yes. Robin, what about you?
I'm going to give you 3 guesses.
Water. No, ginger tea.
Yes. Ginger tea. I'm drinking ginger tea with lemon, but I do have water next to me too. I'm double fisting it tonight. Ginger tea and water.
I have a little bit of a headache today. So I'm actually drinking just strawberry lemonade, but it's a very watered down version of strawberry lemonade because I don't want that much sugar. So I'm being a little bit boring tonight, but since mine is like vaguely pink, I'm going to pretend that it's rosé just because that makes me feel better.
I like that. It is the rosé time of year, as you mentioned.
It is. It makes me so happy. Okay, Marita, next question for you is, what is your connection to the IBD community? Why did you decide on gastroenterology? And then why did you also decide on inflammatory bowel disease?
Yeah, so right out of school, I actually worked at Northwestern Memorial Hospital in Chicago. I worked in abdominal transplant, and I had a lot of patients with liver disease that got liver transplants. And many of those patients ended up having PSC that also had concomitant IBD. So that was kind of my first exposure. I kind of worked my way through from being a nursing assistant to a nurse extern to a nurse to clinical coordinator of transplant, and decided to make my way over to University of Chicago, where I met Dr. Russell Cohen, who is a big IBD expert here in Chicago and nationally. And so I went with the intention of saying, well, this is a, you know, multiple clinic job for hepatology and IBD, thinking, oh, at least I get to stay in liver care. And I ended up loving IBD so much and being so lucky to have his mentorship that I made the official jump away from liver transplant into the IBD community, and I haven't looked back since.
Well, we're happy you made that jump over.
Awesome. Thank you.
So one of the reasons that we were really, really excited to talk to you is that you have decided to become a specialist, especially in ostomy care. And so I'm curious, when did that happen as you were getting involved in the IBD community? How did that decision come about?
Yeah. So University of Chicago has a lot of offsite offices because we try really hard to meet patients where they're at in their community. And so we have many offsite locations. And at the offsite location that I was working as a nurse while I was finishing my degree to become a nurse practitioner, I noticed that we had many patients that were coming to see our colorectal surgeon there and Dr. Cohen. And then they had to make the long haul down to Hyde Park, which is a neighborhood in Chicago, which traffic-wise can be quite tricky for many patients, depending on the time of day, just for their ostomy care. And I thought, well, this doesn't make any sense to have patients that were, you know, we're trying to meet them where they're at with their surgical care and their medical care, but their ostomy care is not there. And so the nurse practitioners that work with our ostomy patients were already spread quite thin at our main campus. So I decided to pursue the additional training while I was in school to become a nurse practitioner. So it was a little hairy there for a minute because I was also about 13 years pregnant is what I usually say, but you know, 7 to 9 months pregnant. So I was getting a lot done, a lot of mental growth, a lot of physical growth, all of that in that time period. But I thought it was important to bring our services to the patients in the community, you know, where they're there for all their other things. Because, you know, the burden of appointments is one of the things we try to limit if possible.
I mean, I guess it's a form of nesting, maybe?
We can call it that. Everyone laughed when I was at U of C because they were like, sit down. You're like 8 months pregnant. You're getting a master's degree. You're doing this training, like chill out. And I'm like, no, this is my time before she comes.
That is a good point.
And then afterwards, I just kept going. They're like, you said that was the time. I'm like, I changed my mind. So
that's allowed. You are welcome to change your mind in those, but that is very cool. I definitely want to stick with Ostomy Care for a little while longer. At our last research roundup episode, you know, a couple of the doctors that we had on, Dr. Abraham and Dr. Knuchen, were talking about, you know, how maybe introducing the topic of surgery earlier in the conversation with patients, so it's not seen as a last resort, is warranted. And so I'm guessing that especially since you have extra knowledge, you feel particularly comfortable talking to patients about this. So walk me through a obviously fake scenario of you have a patient sitting with you and you're kind of at that fork in the road of like, you could talk about surgery that's becoming a more viable option, or you could try something else. And like you said, maybe the medication has failed this person, but like, so now you're there. How do you broach the subject with them? And then, you know, what if there's some pushback on the whole ostomy side of it?
Yeah, absolutely. This year, I think particularly at DDW, the merit of early surgery was discussed regularly. So definitely when I'm meeting with a patient, I try to meet them where they're at. So is this a patient that's newly diagnosed and they are already on information overload? They've come to us with really bad stricturing disease or fulminant colitis, and you know, they are already just, their world has been totally rocked, right? So trying to be sensitive to kind of where they're at in their journey. Or is this somebody that's had Crohn's since they were 12 and they're coming to me in their mid-30s that needs an ileocecectomy, something like that. And that goes for all surgical conversations, you know, notwithstanding the stoma. When I have a patient that I have a high degree of suspicion that they're going to need a stoma, I try to address it early and I try to talk about surgery as another tool in the toolbox. So I usually address medications. If I've got someone who, you know, I work at a tertiary care center, so it's rare to me that I find a bio-naive patient that comes my way. But I generally try to present medications in kind of a menu format of, these are the families of meds that we have. These are why you'd be a great candidate for this medication. Or maybe this one wouldn't quite address all of the symptoms you have. And perhaps this would be a great one for your extraintestinal arthritis or something like that. And I always bring up surgery kind of at the first time I meet patients. And I say, you know, we've got a wide array of medications these days. We still have a finite amount, but surgery may be something that could benefit you in the future. Our goal is to keep you out of surgery. But if you need surgery, it's not the end of the world. And having a stoma can return your quality of life. A big part of having a chronic illness is the lack of control, right? So it's like looking at, okay, so if you're having 20 bloody bowel movements a day, you don't have any control of your life. You're not dropping your kids off at preschool. You're not making it to all your meetings, and you're really suffering. So this is a way to alleviate that in a situation of a patient with maybe fulminant colitis. We also look at patients that might have dysplasia or precancerous changes. And those are patients that, you know, we talk really closely around colon cancer screening. So we look a lot at education right from the start. So I'll say to them, you know, right now you've had colitis for 3 years. So we're screening about every 3 years for disease activity assessment and colon cancer surveillance. But as time goes on, your risk increases. And so we are going to increase your screening, because oftentimes patients that are new to the IBD world and diagnosis think, oh, after a long time, I get screened less. And actually it's the inverse relationship. So we talk about why we do that. And in the event that dysplasia does come up, what are we going to do about it? And so then we talk about a stoma. I try to frame everything around, who's the patient in front of me? Is it somebody with a bunch of young kids? Is it a police officer? Is it someone who's a professional athlete or something like that? And kind of look at, what are your concerns? Tell me what you know about ostomy care. Tell me, you know, do you know anyone with a stoma? Most of the time, people don't know someone with a stoma purely because they haven't told them, because of the wonderful products we have these days. And many patients that do hear about stomas, it's because it's not working well for someone. And so they're kind of letting them in on that. Or they may have had a grandparent or something like that with a colostomy, you know, for, you know, diverticulitis or something like that. And they're like, wait, is that what my ileostomy is going to be like? So kind of reframing those conversations, looking at why they would need it, how it's going to impact their life, and then talking about their specific concerns. Because what concerns, you know, my patient in room one isn't going to concern my patient in room two, and really trying to look at the individualized guidance.
That definitely makes a lot of sense. Since also one of your interests is women's health, I'm guessing that one question you may get from some folks is ostomies and pregnancy at the same time. Like, how do you navigate that? Does that cause any quirky symptoms, issues? Because obviously your abdomen is expanding. And how does that change your ability to like put your bag on and attach things?
Yeah, this is a huge interest of mine as a mom of a 4-year-old. And, you know, as a woman myself, I think that resources and pregnancy, you know, sometimes for some communities are lacking. And so I want to do my part for ostomy care to make sure that's not the case. So typically, you know, the stoma size will expand when the belly is expanding as well. It may, the length of the stoma may get a little bit longer. And there's different interventions that we do in order to help with that. So that way it's not problematic. Sometimes at the end of the third trimester, the baby gets really comfortable on the bowel, and that can cause some intermittent obstructions. So we deal with working on that with patients, and then looking at, as you mentioned, you know, the changing of the pouching system, different strategies with mirrors or perhaps your partner helping you. Typically, ostomy care can remain completely independent throughout pregnancy unless there's, you know, some extenuating circumstances. But we certainly look at, you know, what's the firmness of the belly? You know, is it something that we need to adjust the pouching system? Sometimes we need to do that for the period of pregnancy and even postpartum. I actually have a little bit of a side project going of trying to identify the best baby wearing devices for moms with stomas. Oh. So I have several patients who are sending me little lists in my chart, and my nurses are like, what is this?
I love
that.
And I'm
like, don't worry about it.
I love that so much.
Yeah. Yeah. They're like, I just got a list of, you know, these, you know, Mobi carrier and all these things. I'm like, this is great because it's what works for your baby, but it's what works for you, you know? So I'm trying to make a little bit of a handout for my patients because I do have kind of a growing number of patients that are pregnant with ileostomies. So it's an interesting population, and no two are the same, as no two pregnancies are the same. No two ileostomy experiences are the same. So it's been pretty interesting to grow that, but it's definitely something that's absolutely, you know, able to be handled throughout pregnancy. And it's something that it's really important in those situations too, that we've got patients that even if you've got a really comfortable relationship with your OBGYN, at least at 1 to 2 times during your pregnancy, following up with a maternal fetal medicine doctor who's used to dealing with patients with high risk pregnancies, chronic diseases, previous abdominal and pelvic surgeries, and then at least seeing myself or another ostomy specialist, I say once a trimester, just to make sure that we're not, you know, missing any opportunities to optimize the pouching system. Because I always, my patients laugh at me. They said they were going to get me a t-shirt. I always say predictability is power with your pouching system. And so we need to make sure that we are optimizing things so they're not having any leaks and they're able to move along and enjoy their pregnancy just like anybody else would.
I guess I'm curious about the whole like obstruction thing. Like, is it just a matter of like, do you just poke the baby a little bit or you reposition? Like what, you just wiggle around until they move?
So that usually works in like weeks 30 to 35.
Okay.
And the baby is so big and just like uncomfortable that they're just doing what they do. So typically I do a lot of the stuff I do with a normal obstruction where I'll say, you know, kind of gently massage the area if you're able to get in and out of the bath at that point, maybe with a partner's help for safety. You know, taking a warm bath really, you know, just relaxes abdominal muscles and get baby kind of, you know, kicking around. I'll tell women to do repositioning, get on, you know, all fours, and that can kind of shift baby to the front of your abdomen and off of that. It's usually right behind where the stoma is. So it's a nice, cute little foot there. I can sometimes feel it when I examine the patients and I'll just kind of poke the little foot and then sometimes it moves and everything works out great, but then you'll have dumping into the bag because you've got a big backup at that point. Sometimes I'll have patients do a cold drink or a warm drink or a sugary drink like grape juice to give baby a little, you know, kind of zing to move off, kind of the same things you would do when, you know, you're thinking, has my baby moved enough in this hour? And you, you know, knock back a glass of ice water and the baby goes, whew, you know, they kind of do the same thing off of the bowel, which is usually does the trick. It gets a little trickier in like weeks 37 to week 40 because baby kind of does what it wants.
I am curious, if you have an ostomy and you're pregnant, do you automatically need to have a C-section?
So no. Okay. As a general comment, but it's very individualized. So if you've got a stoma because you've got really bad perianal Crohn's and you've got a diverting stoma in order to let that calm down, that would be a patient that needs a C-section just because of the perianal Crohn's. I have had some patients successfully deliver vaginally. It very much depends on what they've got going on, how long ago their proctectomy was, if they have the rectum in place or not, all of those things. It's very much a joint decision-making process between the mom, myself, the maternal fetal medicine doctor, and making sure that they also have a great colorectal surgeon on call and present for the C-section is helpful, and an IBD specialized colorectal surgeon, because you never know with C-sections and with anything else, you want to have the best people in the room to help you at the moment. And so having that colorectal surgeon you've got a great relationship with and already know who made your stoma present is helpful. So oftentimes women will do a planned C-section so they've got all the appropriate parties in place.
I want to take you back a little bit to the initial conversations where you're meeting patients where they are and you are like addressing this, bringing up surgery earlier, because in a lot of our earlier podcasts, because we've been doing this for 2.5 years, Alicia, we talked about this a lot. Like we screamed it from the rooftops. Surgery is an treatment option, not a last resort. And I wanted to ask you, do you find that you get pushback from patients who are not ready to hear that? Number one. Mm-hmm. And number two, do you find yourself having to address like the language used? Like maybe sometimes patients are coming to University of Chicago for a second opinion and they've been told that they have failed medication or failed treatment. Or so I kind of want to go down that route of patients not ready to learn about surgery and being told that they've failed.
Yeah. So I think in medicine, it's really important that we use person first language for everything, right? So it's not my Crohn's patient or my UC patient. It's my patient that happens to have Crohn's disease, because Crohn's disease is not your entire identity. It's just a part of you. And I think that really travels over to the medication language that we use. Oftentimes as practitioners, we'll say the patient failed infliximab or the patient failed adalimumab or were refractory to cyclosporine or something like that. I think it's really important to use medication first language in this situation, particularly because the patient didn't fail anything. They showed up, they did their part, the medication didn't. And that's okay. It just means we got to move on to the next level. And so trying to tell patients, you know, I see that infliximab wasn't effective for your Crohn's disease. Or I see that despite being on dose optimized Humira, you developed a fistula or a stricture. So we need to move on to something else, a different class of medications, or discuss surgery. So using that medication first language of infliximab failed my patient is really important. And I think that the language that we use surrounding medications as well as surgery really sets the stage for patients. I did a talk recently for our fellows and residents and nurses and nurse practitioners about the language that we use surrounding stomas and surgery. And when we talk about, well, you got to get through this medication and this medication, this medication, and then if all that fails, you'll meet the surgical team. I don't think that that makes a lot of sense, because then the patient feels like an utter failure by the time that they've gotten to surgery. And they've done nothing wrong. They didn't do anything to get Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. And they didn't do anything to make these medications not work. It just happened to be the way that things went down. Right. And so talking to them about, you know, I see that you have been exposed to infliximab. It wasn't effective for your Crohn's disease. You tried, you know, ustekinumab, and that also wasn't effective. So today we're going to talk about having a diverting ileostomy, so that way the surgical team can address the stricture in your colon. Using language like that and not talking about surgery as a failure or a last option. I tell patients all the time, one of our surgeons says this, and I think it's the best analogy. He says, IBD is a team sport, no matter what way you look at it. And so you've got the ostomy care team, you've got the medical team, you've got the surgical team, and we're all working together to optimize the patient's situation. So whatever is right for the patient. I've had patients go through 3 or 4 medications and they don't have super severe colitis, but they're just like, I can't do this anymore with all these medicines and everything else. And they elect to have surgery. Or a patient that has a strict that, you know, we've got medicines that help with inflammation. We don't have medicines yet that help dissolve scar tissue. And so that's a great application of surgery. And so talking with a patient about why they would need surgery, when they would need surgery, and talking about it again is not a failure. They've done nothing to get themselves in this situation. They've showed up to all their infusions. They've done everything that they could possibly do to optimize their situation. And it's our job to make sure we're doing our heavy lifting too, to make sure that the patient is getting back to the quality of life that they want. And that is one of the big things I talk about with stoma care. So I had a patient who, it really touched me, because I am the mom of a preschooler, and was telling me that, you know, she was having 10 to 15 clustered bowel movements in the morning because of her really refractory ulcerative colitis. And she just, all she wanted to do was drive her daughter to preschool. And that was just so crushing for her. And as a mom who kills myself every day to drive my daughter to preschool and pick her up, or how many patients I have on my schedule and everything else, I felt for her. And so she went the route of getting an ostomy. And she said the first day she dropped her daughter off at preschool, she was just weeping in the parking lot, because she was like, now I have control back. I can do this now, where she couldn't before. And so that's what ostomy care is to me, is giving people back their freedom to have control over their lives and not have UC running their life and not have Crohn's running their life.
I could get on a soapbox so fast right now. I'm going to really try not to. One of the things where you said, like, going through all the medications and then, you know, after failing, then considering surgery. Also, patients are so sick by then. Like, they're not well enough to have surgery. Then they're malnourished. Then the outcomes are not going to be good after surgery. Recovery is not going to be good. There's so many reasons. I want to ask you about situation. I mean, okay. I feel like I'm all over the place right now because of that story and me crying a little bit.
It's moving.
It's very moving.
It's the best part about my job.
My first temporary ostomy when my daughters were 3 and 1. So what about situations where the patient doesn't have the opportunity to have the discussion beforehand? Like, they wake up in the hospital with an ostomy and they haven't had a chance to, like, talk to you in advance. They haven't had a chance to, like, learn how to take care of this in advance, to see what an ostomy looks like, to get a sample pouching system, how does an ostomy nurse in the hospital explain all of this to somebody who's just woken up from surgery and they have to try to figure it out in that kind of situation?
Yes. I mean, that's such an emotional journey for a patient. When you start in the pre-op clinic with the ostomy nurse and the surgeon that hopefully you've met prior to that meeting, and your, you know, attending physician or IBD care provider, and we're all talking about it together and how we're going to support you and we're going to be there, and you've got that time to kind of mull things over, that helps a little bit with the emotional transition, even though it's going to be different regardless of how well prepared you are. When you're in a situation where you wake up with you had an emergency surgery, say whether you've got IBD or whether you had a trauma surgery or something like that, that is a huge emotional and, you know, psychological adjustment. And I think the most important role for the ostomy care nurse in that situation is not only teaching you how to care for the ostomy. To me, that's the easy stuff. That's the stuff that we can teach in our sleep. It's remembering that even though this is the 12th patient you've seen today who has an ostomy, this is the first time they're hearing this information. This is something that I think we all need to remind ourselves in all avenues of care that, you know, it may feel rote for us, but this is the first time that this has ever happened to this person. And we need to be really sensitive and really cognizant of that. So I think the first thing is, you know, at U of C, we feel really strongly about criteria for discharge is your pain is under control, you know, you're healing well, but also that you can fully independently care for that stoma. And so that's how highly we value stoma care at U of C. And so the ostomy nurse, their role is to see that patient every single day that they're in the hospital if they're having a hard time adjusting to that stoma. Some patients will say, hey, this is my second stoma or my third stoma. I'm cool. I just need supplies. And the stoma nurse will say, it's been so great to see you again or nice to meet you or, you know, all of that. But for a patient that's really struggling, it's really important that we partner with them, that we learn about them, learn what their lifestyle is. Are they somebody who's an avid runner and they're worried about being able to run and sweat and get back to a half marathon or whatever they do? Is this a mom? Is this a firefighter? And really addressing, you know, what are their specific concerns regarding their lifestyle with the stoma? And then also really educating about appropriate skincare so you can get a great pouch seal and looking at ways to optimize the effluent or the output from the stoma and looking at how the patient is receiving that information. Because we all the time will go on our little speech and we do the same speech every time just so we remember everything. And then you look over at the patient and they're just totally glazed over and just information overload and nothing else is seeping in today. And that's okay. It's a huge adjustment. So I think really trying to offer information and education in multiple formats. So doing teaching visits where you're hands-on with them, they're helping with the stoma, you're helping with the stoma, maybe a caregiver or a partner is there as well, giving them written format. And then I love to follow up. I'm a big MyChart fan. So I always follow up with MyChart messages and things like that. So that way they can easily refer to them if, you know, they lose the paperwork you provide them in the hospital, and really just making sure that they feel confident and comfortable and that they know who to call if they don't. If they run into trouble, the ER is not suited for stoma care. It just isn't. And so oftentimes, you know, I myself, and I know many of my colleagues, I've got emergency slots on my schedule purely to keep people out of the ER because the ER is not going to help them if they're having leaks or things like that. And so trying to make sure that they're really plugged in appropriately so they know who to call if they're in trouble.
Yeah, I want to reiterate that. You should, when you get discharged from the hospital, because not everybody is fortunate enough to go to the University of Chicago, when you get discharged from the hospital, they should give you a phone number for a local or somebody close to you, a wound and ostomy care nurse or clinic close to you. They should give that to you. And if they don't, you should be able to ask for it.
Absolutely. And another, just another thing that is helpful for patients is the United Ostomy Associates of America website, UOAA.org, has a directory. So you can oftentimes, I'll see patients because they came for really refractory disease, but I'm like, you are traveling 3 hours to see me. Like, there are people closer. I adore seeing you, but I don't want you to be running up your gas bills just for me. So they oftentimes will connect them with someone a little bit closer to home or more geographically convenient for them. Because again, our whole goal with IBD care is, you know, the burden outside of the bathroom is huge. You know, being in the bathroom is a huge deal, but all of the infusions and appointments and blood draws and scans and colonoscopies, they add up. So trying to make it more convenient for patients is really important. And that's a good resource to do that.
You can ask the hospital too. My hospital, when I had my surgery, was 6 hours away, and they did give me a contact for someone a lot closer to where I actually live. So even if you are driving hours, you can ask the hospital where your procedure is to get you connected to somebody closer.
That's great.
I'm very curious, in your work with all of these ostomates, have you gotten any tips and tools and tricks that they have taught you that were things that maybe you didn't think about, or anything unexpected that you've learned from folks?
I am always amazed at the things that patients come up with when they're at home, because it's so different. You know, I always say to them, sometimes I'll see patients, you know, on an annual basis after they've been really comfortable with their stoma for a while for insurance purposes, for renewing their supplies and everything. And I usually say to them, when I see them for the first time, you show me how you change your pouching system, because it's an opportunity for me to learn. You know, I can have them sit, you know, recumbent in the exam table and do the whole thing myself. But what am I learning from that? I think it's great to learn the way they're doing things at home, because it helps me troubleshoot with them if things aren't going great, but also because it really teaches me a lot about the way that people do it. I had one patient tell me that, you know, she would stand, you know, at her bathroom sink. And I had one patient tell me that at the kitchen table was the best place to do it, because it had the best light and it was, you know, kind of removed from her kitchen and was able to see things the best to make sure her skin was in good condition. And, you know, we've got patients that do varying ways of applying their pouching system of, do they put their ring on their skin, or do they put it on the bag, or how do they do all of that? So it's interesting to see. And it's also interesting to see how invested caregivers and family members are too. For a lot of patients, I think that's the big fear when you go into having a stoma, is how is this going to affect my intimate life? How is this going to affect the way that my partner or my loved ones perceive me? Or for some of, I have a ton of college kids as patients, and they're like, I'm not married, I don't have this, I don't have that. And it's really bringing forth that, you know, people want to be involved. The people in your life love you and they want to help you. And they might also just think your stoma is really cool. So it's a cool thing to do. I have a patient who, her 9-year-old son does not miss a pouching change. Like, he is there for it. And so it's, you know, it's great. It's great to be able to get the people who love you involved. And it's always, you know, there's not one day that passes by that I do not learn something new from my patients, which is so rewarding for me, because I don't have a stoma. So it's, I always tell them, you know, I do this all day, but I don't have a stoma. So I'm here to learn from you too.
I do remember, I don't remember if it was one of their guests or somebody else that was talking about that, one of the weird things they've learned is they eat a marshmallow before they're going to do a bag change, because it's slows everything down.
Slows your output.
Mm-hmm. Who was that?
We've talked about that. A couple of people. I mean, it might have even been with Stacy and I, or Jasmine, maybe Jasmine.
It might've been Jasmine. Yeah. Yeah. But I was like, of all the wacky things. And then I'm also like, maybe I should never eat marshmallows. That's like, I don't think I need to slow anything down in my life, unfortunately.
I'm always amazed when I watch like MasterChef Junior and there's like a 6-year-old making marshmallows. Yep. I'm like, how do you make a marshmallow? But yes, there's definitely some merit to that. A lot of patients do that. I often tell people, you know, find the time where your output is the slowest or the thickest and the easiest to control. It's different for everybody. Some people will say, I wake up with watery output and then it thickens up throughout the day. Some patients will tell me, you know, it's very thick throughout the day and then it kind of gets watery before bedtime. It's usually dependent on diet, but it's also, there's no two patients with IBD that are exactly the same on the inside. So it's very, very unique to each patient. But the marshmallow trick is one that a lot of my patients use.
Also, if you're relatively new to an ostomy, and when I say relatively new, I mean the first few years, 1, 2, 3 years, your body is still figuring out how to live without your colon. So what Marita is saying, you're not going to know these things. It takes your body time to adjust, to develop these patterns. So if you're 2 years in and you're like, I don't have a pattern, I don't have a regular stool, I don't know when my stool is more solid or more liquid, that's because your body's still learning. So don't get frustrated. If you're listening, I'm going to bump it up to 15. Of the 15 people who are listening, if you're listening and you're like, my body doesn't know yet, if you're still in early days, 1, 2, even 3 years in, your body's still learning how to function. Your small intestines are still learning how to do their thing as a pseudo large intestine. So give yourself as much time as it takes.
There's a physical acclimation process that happens within your small bowel, and it takes everybody a different length of time. And I tell every single patient, there is not one person that's ever been recorded on the planet to have been born with a stoma. And so as you learned, you know, potty training as a toddler, as you learn new skills, as you got new degrees, things like that, all of that takes time. And so you need to give yourself grace as you get to know your stoma and your stoma gets to know you.
So especially for people who may be living with a permanent ostomy, can you give an idea? Because like, I know there's also some things that like Stacey and Robin have talked about, Stacey Collins, RD extraordinaire, has talked about like having to make some dietary changes to adjust for the fact that like your colon is what absorbs a lot of liquid. And so maybe you have to increase your liquid for a little while to kind of accommodate that. Is there kind of a timeline by which your body is like, oh, wait, I get that this is what I'm working with now?
There's typically after about 6 months postoperative, as long as your small bowel is healthy, okay. I should say. Typically, you know, any surgeon doing IBD surgery, I'm very lucky to be surrounded by many IBD expert surgeons, they do as much small bowel sparing as possible. And so if it's small bowel that we can treat with medication, they try to kind of leave things in place. So we try, you know, looking at what the stoma's purpose was. Is it somebody with refractory ulcerative colitis who their small bowel is normal? They're going to acclimate in like 6 months usually, is my usual guesstimate, depending on how sick right. they were going into surgery. As Robin mentioned before, if there's somebody that was on TPN and having a lot of malnutrition, it might take a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. But looking at a patient, you know, as long as they've got healthy small bowel, it's typically 6 months to a year is what we see. And it's a great way to get your amazing registered dietitians involved. We've got some IBD specialized RDs in our practice that are just, they always laugh. They say I'm like their hype girl, but I really am. I am like between our RDs, our GI psychologist, and then our specialty pharmacy team. I'm like, I know that if y'all weren't here, I'd be doing all of this and not as well. So I'm so grateful to have, you know, a big multidisciplinary team, but there's definitely huge diet impact on output, and just educating proactively, I think, is really important. I had a patient call me recently who was like, you know, I went out for my 40th birthday and I had a few drinks with my buddies and I started dumping in the middle of the night. And I was like, yes, alcohol will do that. Sugar will do that. So he said, you told me that, but that was at the beginning and I forgot. And I was like, that's okay. Mistakes happen. I was even as a patient, you know, someone that doesn't have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease or a stoma, sometimes you eat stuff that just doesn't jive with you. And sometimes there's no way you could have anticipated that, no matter how careful you are. And so those are things that we just try to educate about proactively and then continually reinforce, because as you know, some people forget and that's okay. So I often will say to patients when they come in, you know, tell me about what you're eating. Tell me about, you know, have you cooked anything great lately? Is there something that, you know, you enjoy to eat more than something else? And are there things that you've had to cut out of your diet that perhaps you don't want to? Because we always want to avoid any unnecessary restriction, because that can obviously lead to vitamin deficiencies and all of that. So always making sure that we're doing a really comprehensive dietary intake. I usually do a 24-hour recall when I see patients, just to make sure that we're on a good place with their dietary intake calorically and nutritionally and all of that. But it's a great way to loop in the RD team as well, because we kind of work in concert to make sure that output is optimal. And looking as well at, you know, patients will, any small bowel stoma is usually called an ileostomy. And the ileum is the last part of the small bowel. And typically, you know, where in the ileum your stoma is matters. Oftentimes I'll have patients that are so high up in the ileum that they actually have more of a jejunostomy almost, which is the center part of the small bowel. And so that has a huge impact on output. And so looking at what is the true location of the stoma? And that's a really important piece that any stoma nurse and medical team should be looking at, because, you know, for insurance coding and things like that, all small bowel stomas are coded as an ileostomy. And so it makes a difference. And that would be a great time as well to get in, you know, an MD nutritionist too, because sometimes patients will need things that will kind of help their bowel absorb a little better. And those are the people to help with that.
Fascinating. I guess that makes sense, but that's really interesting.
Huh. It is.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky for patients, because they're like, well, I have an ileostomy. I'm like, sort of.
Is that getting like, into the short bowel realm when they have when it's the jejunum, yeah, and not the ileum?
Definitely. Yeah. So that's one of the first things that I look at with surgery. Mm-hmm. is did they have their, how many small bowel resections have they had, if any? Mm-hmm. And if they've had those, has anybody measured their bowel during surgery to see? I'm very lucky that I work at a place where our surgeons measure the bowel if there's any suspicion for short gut or things like that. Not all places have that. So you really got to look at your operative report with a close eye as a stoma care nurse, or really any healthcare provider with a patient with a stoma. If the output doesn't make sense, that there's something else in the driver's seat. So oftentimes patients can have, you know, diabetic medications that are kind of messing with their output, or have adrenal insufficiency or things like that. So if the output doesn't make sense, I always say I'm like getting in my Nancy Drew mode. I'm like, okay, well, your bowel is long enough. Well, this is, so now we've got to do some more investigation. So it's important to always keep that in mind as well.
Oh, that's really interesting. Now, like, are there other things that you have to do for people who may take other types of medication? Like, are there medications that aren't absorbed really in the same way anymore? Like, I guess I'm thinking, you know, some of our folks struggle with mental health issues. And so if you're on a, you know, a medication for your mental health, does that screw it up?
Yeah. So I had a patient come to me who was at a local community hospital, had an ileostomy placed, and then came because she was like, hey, I didn't even know I had Crohn's disease. I thought I had appendicitis. And then they came in and I had just a terrible stricture, and they ended up placing an ileostomy during surgery. And she's like, upset during the visit. And I'm like, this is a lot for you. I understand you walked in with one expectation, you walked out with an entirely new reality. And so let's unpack that. Like, tell me how you feel about everything. And throughout talking about that, she had said, I've struggled with anxiety my entire life and all these other things. I said, do you take anything for anxiety? And she said, yes. And we went, reviewed all of her medications, and all of them were extended release, which means none of them were being absorbed. They were ending up in her pouching system. And as many people who take, you know, those medications know, it can take 4 to 6 weeks for you to feel the therapeutic effect.
Yeah.
So that is a really long time for someone to have to ramp back up into therapeutic range for their symptom control, for their anxiety or depression. So it's always important to let every single prescriber know, I have an ileostomy, an extended release might not be for me. And if it is an extended release, but it's, you know, absorbed higher up in the small bowel, that's fine. But just knowing, you know, where it releases in the bowel is really, really important. So that's something I tell all of my patients when I see them for that first post-op visit is, let's do a comprehensive review of every single medication that enters your body, whether it's over the counter, an herb, a supplement, anything, because if they're taking any supplements over the counters, prescriptions that are extended release, they're likely not getting the entire benefit of that medication. And so it's important to review that as the stoma nurse, but also they need to let every prescriber know, I have an ileostomy, and please keep in mind where that medication releases. So that way they aren't taking a medication that's not giving them a benefit, or they're losing therapeutic benefit from a medication because it's extended release.
Yeah, that is mind-boggling. I guess I did not even think about that, but that makes a whole lot of sense, the whole extended release thing. I think Robin and I both were staring at you like, what? That's right. Holy shit.
Honestly, a lot of times I'm like, can this just be injected? Because with the J pouch and stuff, and when I had ostomies, I'm like, can I just get this in an injection? I don't even want to take it as a pill. Just if it can be like injected, just give me an injection.
Oral solution? Like, would that, does that help?
Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. We have patients all the time. We'll work with our pharmacy team to see if, you know, we need to go to a compounding pharmacy, or it's something that can be done, you know, in the home type of thing. And it's, you know, it's very individualized and medication specific. So I would encourage everyone to always reach out to their local pharmacist regarding this, or whoever's prescribing the medicine, but you're totally right. And sometimes patients, their preference will be an injection, and that's okay. Yeah. You know, for me, I know I'm not a person who does well taking pills every day. I do not remember anything. And so if you told me, oh, you can take this once, or you can take this once a week or something, I would be all game for that. So I think people sometimes think, oh, a pill is safer, a pill is more convenient, when in fact, for some people it isn't. So that's where that shared decision-making really, you know, kind of comes home to roost.
Well, and I think of also like our folks, like, you know, Robin has talked about doing iron, you know, needing iron, and iron infusions are frankly work faster and you don't feel sick when you're doing it, unlike some iron pills. And so that can, for some folks, that's really a better option for them, you know, just because they top you up a little faster. Totally. So as an ostomy nurse that's been doing this for a while, one of the things Robin has bemoaned on this podcast is the fact that ostomy technology has not necessarily changed very quickly, despite the 20 years ago when she had her first and the 20 years later. What'd you say, Robin? They've added some Velcro to the bag instead of a clip.
Right, exactly. They've added Velcro instead of a clip. That's been 20 years between ostomies for me. Woo, fancy.
So as an ostomy professional, what would you want to see change about ostomy technology? If you had a magic wand,
That's a big question. You know, I'm working on a clinical trial currently for an ostomy related device. And I was so excited because I was like, when's the last time anybody heard about a clinical trial for an ostomy related device?
Honestly.
Yeah. And it was actually a device made by an ostomate himself, who happened to also be an engineer, who was sick of dealing with leaks and, you know, developed a stainless steel device that was helpful for, you know, increasing predictability, which is great.
Fascinating.
But yeah. You know, we've come a long way I've been in the ostomy space for, gosh, I guess maybe 6 years. And in that time period, you know, we've now got rings and pouching systems for people with peristomal hernias. So we think about convexity in ostomy care as, you know, a flat pouch, usually for a flat abdomen with a great protrusion on their stoma. You can use convexity for patients that need to increase their stoma protrusion. And then now we've got concave pouches as well for patients that have that bulging area around their stoma for a hernia. We also have some new moldable devices that are, you know, I've had varying results in my clinic. So it's really, you know, it's hard to say. I was very excited when I saw the concave pouching systems. And then when I saw the new convex rings come out, so that way patients can kind of adjust on a flat bag if they've already got a full box of supplies at home. I think for me, I would say a filter that works the entire time that they're wearing it would be the best solution. That's the thing I hear most from patients is, you know, the charcoal filter works great for about 24 hours and then it's done for. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's the thing I hear the most durably. It's so hard to say because you know, like I said, there, it's not quite as dynamic a landscape in terms of treatment options as, you know, IBD care is. So it's not something that I usually think about. And I would also say some pouching systems that perhaps address the needs of some of our patients that have peristomal pyoderma. Mm. That is a huge clinical interest of mine, working on getting some clinical trials up and running with some of our team members here. And oftentimes, generally speaking, ostomy care, the simpler the pouching regimen, the better for patients. With pyoderma, it gets really tricky because oftentimes there's ulcerated skin around the stoma, so you don't have that same level of pouch adhesion. So I would say a wafer or a pouching system that helps address that. So whether that's something with, you know, silver alginate in it or something like that to help address, you know, the antimicrobial perspective as well as, you know, drainage.
Well, I was wondering if there's any need for some type of test that's incorporated into some, like somehow the pouch or the ring or something that's there, or even like the cream that's used on the skin that would be able to like test pH or do some things like that, that maybe would be able to give you as the provider some insight into, you know, malabsorption issues or things like that.
I think, to my understanding, that hasn't even been studied or addressed at all.
Patent pending. Patent pending.
Yes, you got it. You heard it here first. So I think, you know, there's definitely been a lot of interesting studies that are coming out about using, you know, sweat or using wearable devices to predict a flare. And so that certainly would be interesting, especially in, you know, our pyoderma population as well, because it's, you know, an inflammatory manifestation on the skin. It kind of tells you what's going on the inside. And so it would definitely be an interesting, you know, to see that. I think we're far away from that time, but maybe that will be I've got about 5 steps on this trial that I've developed. Maybe that will be number 6.
I love it. I want to ask you very quickly about the peristomal pyoderma gangrenosum. This is a terrifying name. Explain what this is in very simple terms. And then why does this happen?
Yes. So peristomal pyoderma gangrenosum is an ulcerated area of the skin. It's a full thickness wound that happens near the stoma. Some patients can also experience pyoderma on other parts of their body when they don't have a stoma. The reasons as to why are still really up for debate. Okay. There's a paucity of data. So we're trying to figure out, you know, what the risk factors are for patients. But generally speaking, oftentimes a common clinical scenario that I will see is a patient that undergoes a colectomy because they have really bad ulcerative colitis. They plan to get a J pouch. So their rectum is still in place. They've got their ileostomy. And they'll tell me, you know, I started passing bloody mucus from my rectum, and now I've got this pinhole next to my stoma. And I'm like, oh no, it's coming. And it usually ends up coming into this, you know, full thickness wound. It's very painful for patients. It can have drainage that's bloody or tan. can, and it often can be really, really hard to treat. It's something that we try to treat topically to start with topical steroids or topical calcineurin inhibitors. We oftentimes have to progress to oral therapies, and then we also topically treat the rectum. So oftentimes we'll put steroids in a foam form or an enema form into the rectum, because it's usually what I tell patients is this is my barometer of what's happening on the inside. So until I fix what's going on the inside, we are not going to fix your pyoderma for the most part, is usually what happens in clinic. So we've got to really optimize their therapy and make sure that they are in a true remission. And if they've got an area of active disease, that we are addressing that. And typically the pyoderma tends to kind of go with the course of the luminal disease. Sometimes there are outliers, but typically if luminal disease is under control, then their pyoderma will kind of stay at bay. But we do have some patients that have had really, really refractory pyoderma and have even required, you know, stoma resighting and things like that, which is why it's really important to jump on quickly. And if it's an area that you are not comfortable with, it's not something that we see all that often in clinical practice. You know, in ostomy, my ostomy care book, there was like a 3-sentence paragraph about pyoderma.
Oh, wow.
And in medical training, there isn't all that much either. And so it's definitely an emerging area that we're seeing much more frequently. So we're trying to figure out why and who those patients are that are at risk. So it's something that if it's not your clinical area of expertise, definitely reach out to someone who is much, you know, sees it more or, you know, something like that, because, you know, the data just, it's, we don't have a ton of stuff, you know, on the internet to kind of look up and say, oh, what should I do? So there's not a ton of guidance that you're going to find, you know, out there. So it's something that if you do have a patient with refractory pyoderma who is, you know, struggling to get things improved, send them our way or to a stoma nurse who sees it frequently, because the trickiest part about pyoderma is it can spread quickly around the stoma and it impacts the pouch seal. And so having the pouch seal be impacted means that a patient may start having leakage. And those are the things that, you know, really impact quality of life. So if someone's having leakage and they have a super painful ulcer next to their stoma, they're not going to be going out to their kids' soccer games. They're not going to be going to work. So you need to get tight control of it as quickly as possible.
Yikes. Okay. That's scary sounding.
But we're trying to find more data. So hopefully it won't be as scary in the future.
Well, Marita, it has been such a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you. Thank you so much. I have learned a lot and this was so interesting. But last question for you. If you had one piece of advice for the IBD community, what would it be? And again, since you are one of our professionals that works with professionals and also works with patients, you can do one piece of advice for either group or both groups.
So I would say for professionals, my biggest piece of advice would be not talking about stomas as a failure, not talking about surgery as a last resort, framing this as another tool in the toolbox, because if we don't, that completely impacts the patient's attitude and outlook on what stoma care looks like for them. And it really negatively impacts the patient's quality of life after surgery because they're looking at it from this negative language point of view. So using positive language or neutral language when talking about surgery is really important. And for patients, I would say as a stoma nurse that surgery doesn't mean the end of the world. This can be the thing that opens you back up to the world. So if you're stuck in the bathroom having really refractory disease or having dysplasia or things like that, don't think of a stoma as my life is over. This could be your life, you know, kind of beginning a new chapter because now you've got freedom again. And so thinking about a stoma as something that isn't the end of the world, we've got resources, we've got other patients who are so generous with their knowledge. I'm always so amazed at how generous patients are with their knowledge and experience to help somebody else out. Utilizing those resources of CCFA and, you know, your local IBD expert and all of that is huge. And that a stoma really can be the start of a new beginning if you've had a really rough time. It can sound really scary, but just because it's the unknown doesn't mean it's worse. And this can be the beginning of you taking control back of your life, getting IBD out of the driver's seat and you getting back in yourself.
I love that. Yeah, I think that's really great. And it reminds me, as you were talking about working with patients, it reminded me a lot of our past guest and friend of the show, Matt Kasabian, who, you know, his ostomy nurse is really what helped him reframe living with an ostomy. And really, it was such a positive experience for him that like it was life-changing. And so I think, you know, that's just really beautiful to think of how you're going to touch people's lives with this and about, like you said, using this type of language that really helps people understand that this can be so impactful for them. So I think that's awesome. Thank you so much for sharing all of this. This was so good. So, so good. Yes.
So good. Thank you so much, Marita.
Thank you.
And thank you everyone else for joining us and cheers.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers. Hi, this is Marita. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate, review, subscribe, and share it with your friends. Thank you.